This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Today is the fourth episode of our Mind the Health Gap series, where we've been looking at improving healthcare accessibility. Today, we are looking at making hospitals, but also generally healthcare facilities, more friendly for people with disabilities. Of course, if you have issues with mobility, it can be challenging to find your way around a hospital or perhaps even to get there in the first place. And with concerns that more people will find themselves living with disabilities due to age and other illnesses, it's more important than ever to ensure that our healthcare facilities are disability friendly. Today, I'm speaking to Professor Dr. Tan Mo Pin, consultant geriatrician at University of Malaya Medical Center, and Aisha Roos, an adult living with spinal muscular atrophy, more commonly known as SMA. And I'm going to get their thoughts, different perspectives on how they think our healthcare facilities can be more friendly for people with disabilities. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are the both of you?
Overwhelmed.
Doing
great. Yeah, but I think things are settling down a little bit. Yeah.
And it's a sign that we need to get on with life, I think, and get on with issues that perhaps were pushed aside because of the pandemic. One of them, I think we need to look at what our healthcare system as a whole really needs in terms of improvements and reform. I mentioned SMA because it's going to play a role, I guess, in our conversation with Shah and what perspective she brings into this. SMA, as I understand it, is a genetic condition affecting the motor nerve cells in the spinal cord. So your muscles become progressively weaker. That's probably the dummy's understanding of SMA. But Shah, please do give us a bit more insights into how SMA affects your mobility. You were diagnosed with it from a very young age. Is that right?
That's correct. Actually, I was misdiagnosed as spinal muscular dystrophy when I was a lot younger than 4 years old. And then we did the whole rigmarole of testing and going to and from doctors. So if anyone is understanding of the whole medical system, I think I would be a great example. Eventually, the doctors realized, oh, it's not dystrophy, it's spinal muscular atrophy that pushed me along the entire thing about not just conventional medicine, but also traditional medicine and magical heebie-jeebie stuff.
Would you like to talk a little bit, you know, for the benefit of listeners who aren't as well-versed with SMA, how exactly does it affect your mobility?
SMA is a degenerative disease. So when I was younger, I could still run around and partake in various activities. But as I got older, specifically when I reached 18, 19, I started having to use the wheelchair more. And now I'm completely non-ambulatory, which means I cannot walk by myself. So I use a travel scoot to get around, which is a motorized scooter that is like a three-wheeled thing, very lightweight. The thing is, it's very, very expensive and people make jokes about oh, we're going to mod it and put NOS and increase the wheels. And I'm like, y'all don't realize that it is very, very expensive. And if you break it, I will be very sad.
And it is your one mode of transportation. It allows you to be mobile as much as possible. But, you know, in terms of being able to get around independently, though, what are your challenges in terms of looking at spaces? Malaysia is not known for being very friendly towards people who are less mobile.
Absolutely. I think I'm just going to bring this up because this is very recent. Usually I use the scooter to get around near my house. This is the first problem that I'm going to bring up. Pavements in this country, not great. Up until recently, I could go to the cafe very near my house and the pavements, I could just roll over. Now they made it like 2 inches high and I don't understand why they would do that under the pretext of we're making things beautiful. I guess aesthetics trumps mobility. Aside from that, we're talking about using public transportation. I was in Melbourne for a good 4 years for my university degree. And what I loved about being in Melbourne is how mobile I got to be. I was involved in various exhibitions and other things that students tend to do when they're bulking up their CVs. But what was great was I could go anywhere. The trains were very accessible, although, you know, when it rains, you have to brave a little bit of the rain to get to the front of the train, flag the conductor down, he'll come out, take out a ramp for you. And that was amazing to me. Everything was ramped, except if I remember one of the other places had like a 45 degree angle ramp, which I don't understand, which happens a lot in this country, by the way. I don't know what the policymakers are doing when they okay these things. And mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm in a wheelchair, not the X Games.
Absolutely. Okay, so Prof Tan, that I guess, you know, Shah's perspective gives us one picture of very, very valuable insights about how somebody, you know, perhaps in a wheelchair or a scoot like hers, already has challenges. Now, if we look at the older population, a lot more diverse, what are the different challenges that make it difficult for them to physically navigate spaces?
The challenges are huge. And while the disability lobby is very strong and people do kind of, in some ways, pay attention to the younger adult with disability who is able to shout very loud. But when it comes to older people, nobody wants to do anything. They just assume it's their adult children's responsibility. Do you know how many people it takes to get an older adult to a clinic in a hospital? At least three. Because one person has to stay with the older adult, especially one with cognitive difficulties, because otherwise it would just disappear and will never be seen ever again. But one person is not enough, you know, because that person still has to rummage in the bag, still has to go to the toilet. So if they're on their own, they could run the risk of, you know, accidentally peeing themselves or, you know, injuring themselves because there is no one to help them when their attention is waned. Okay. The other thing is that when we look at the older adults going to hospital, you also need someone to take the number, collect the medications, and that's the second person. And then finally, the third person parks the car, because it can't take as long to park the car as it takes for the entire process to happen. So it's an army to take an older person to hospital. Yeah, and who can afford that army? Not many people. And when you point this out to hospital administrators, they don't have any sympathy. They just go, it's their adult children's. They just say it's their family's responsibility to get to bring them to hospital. Nothing to do with me. So that's what we're facing today. And if anything, you know, we think that things would be getting better. No, they're not. Because the number of older people are increasing faster than we could ever imagine. And people have compassion fatigue.
Do we have a problem of the older adults and your older patients, for instance, potentially not even coming to healthcare facilities because they don't have that army at hand?
Yes, it's all the time. So when I see the patient, they make that special effort to see me in clinic. But I have to make sure that my follow-ups are not too frequent, because otherwise I run into the territory of caregiver stress and then they don't end up coming at all. But when I say physiotherapy, you know, come in for scans, the answer is no. Who's going to bring me? You know, my son has to work. And then the other one is if they come to clinic, sometimes they have to wait for a long time, etc. And then they get very tired. So then next time they get agitated. Actually, to be honest, they get agitated and then they get labeled. And then next time either they decide not to come again or that they're not welcome at the clinic. Yeah. So it is a huge challenge. And until we actually address this challenge, we are in no way even scratching the surface of meeting the healthcare needs of our older adults.
So we have a picture of older adults as probably, you know, dealing with lots of different physical frailties. You mentioned some of them may have dementia and that would impair them cognitively, being able to navigate, figure out where they're supposed to go, perhaps. What are some other health challenges that you see among the older adult population that relates to what we're talking about today?
Okay, cognitive impairment. So sometimes it's under the radar, so they can turn up sometimes because if they're physically independent, some of them still drive and the children just see them on a regular basis, relatives see them on a regular basis. So they have no idea that something is not right. So they could get lost in the, totally lost in the system. So I have patients whom I'll say, can you stop this medications? I'll see you again. Knowing that they have cognitive impairment and already write it down in the notes and things like that, and on a sheet of paper, and then you can bet your bottom dollar when they do manage to remember to come, but they've not actually done anything you ask them to do, like organize a scan or stop that medication. So so there is no one I can actually no system that allows me to actually follow up on their. You know, the management plan, so-called. Yeah. And then they need more information afterwards, because, you know, sometimes you diagnose someone with dementia and then you ask them to go home. There's no information to follow up about what dementia is like, what sort of things. And, you know, a lot of these things are actually available on the internet, but you don't expect the older adult to be able to access that information with some assistance. So we don't have like literature that's widely available. We don't have counseling services. We don't have, you know, ideally they should all come for a class, isn't it, about their condition. And then they meet other people with the same condition. Those sort of things are really not there. We don't treat dementia. We don't treat older person's illness as a chronic illness. So it's a much more chronic illness, if you like, than diabetes or hypertension. But while we're much getting better at treating diabetes, we are not addressing any of these older adult issues like multiple medications, physical disability, functional impairment, and syndromes such as dementia, falls, urinary incontinence, don't get me started. That people actually make them incontinent when they come to hospital. You are actually forcefully made to pee in your diapers when you come to hospital because the hospital infrastructure is so poor that it's not safe, not safe for the older person to go to the toilet in the hospital.
Not safe in the sense that the bathrooms it themselves don't have the necessary, you know, the rails and
the
things
floor.
Like that?
The floor is slippery. So they slip and fall. The beds are too high. They can't get down without falling down. And then there is no handrails at the right places. So the nurse just asks them to wear diapers and do it in their diapers. It's horrendous. Absolutely soul wrecking. And one of the main reasons why I do everything I can to avoid my own older parents ever having to go to hospital. And I'm very choosy about if they do have to go to hospital, who's going to take care of them. I make it quite clear that these kind of practices is not allowed, you know. But I can't do that for the whole nation, even though I would very much like to.
Not all old adults have that privilege as well. Such a heartbreaking, perspective, because we see an older person's dignity being taken away from them.
Yes.
Their right to access healthcare, being taken away simply because the system doesn't cater for their needs. And when we come back from the break, I want to hear more from Shah about how, you know, if you are in a wheelchair, ramps you mentioned, right? Let's just look at how healthcare facilities are built and designed, and you know how stressful it must be for someone with a disability or with mobility issues when they're actually in the building. I'm speaking to Aisha Roos, an adult living with SMA. I forgot to mention she's also an interior designer and an aged and disability fit out specialist. So definitely that perspective is going to be so valuable as we continue to look at how we can make healthcare facilities disability friendly, as well as Professor Dr. Tan Mo Pin, consultant geriatrician. Stay tuned, we'll be right back. Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. My guests today, Aisha Roos, an adult living with SMA and an interior designer as well as an aged and disability fit-out specialist. Also joining her, Professor Dr. Tan Mo Pin, consultant geriatrician. It's the fourth episode of our Mind the Health Gap series. In terms of improving healthcare accessibility, we're looking at the actual logistical, physical access of healthcare facilities for people who are less mobile, who have disabilities or other functional impairments that they just need a bit more support. They need an enabling environment that can help them to get to the healthcare facility as well as to navigate the space. So, Shah, I mean, you know, you would think that hospitals should be, of all places, disability friendly. Have you found that to be the case?
I have not. I have so many issues with that. Piggybacking on what the good doctor has said, it's all true. None of it are lies. I'm going to walk through my personal process of going to the hospitals. Mind you, I haven't been to the hospital for 2 years. First of all, because of COVID. Second of all, it requires an entire team, as the good doctor has said. I need to enlist the support of my brother or my father, anybody that can effectively lift me out of the car, set up the scooter. Thankfully, though, I am quite mobile by myself once I'm set up. I think I have an angry enough face that nobody would bother me if they left me alone, which is a good thing. But the whole concept of going there, let's say I don't have my siblings or my parents' help or anybody around me, friends, maybe, I would have to get public transportation. Public transportation, let's go with the MRT or LRT. I could possibly get there, but I first have to negotiate first mile, last mile.
Mm-hmm.
How do I get there? Are the buses accessible? Most often, maybe you might get one that has the ramp. I have to then figure out how to get on the pavement, because sometimes you have motorbikes parking there. You have pavements that is, I know it says kaki lima, but it doesn't have to be 5 feet tall. and then let's say I finish the first and last mile, first mile, and I'm at the LRT. What's to say the lift isn't broken? There's a funny meme somebody took a picture of, and it says, instead of saying, sorry, lift Rosa, it says, sorry, life Rosa. And I'm like, I relate to that so hard. And then we get to the hospital. Putting aside public transportation, LRT and MRT, this happened to me just recently, and I booked a Grab. My friend was with me, thankfully, and the Grab driver said, I'm sorry, I cannot help you because it's against company policy. I understand that from a COVID perspective. But if you're disabled and you're alone, you need somebody to help lift you up or at least assist you in the car. If a Grab driver or any rideshare driver says, I can't help you, what's the point of getting a rideshare, right?
Yeah.
So that's another problem. Okay, now we get to being at the hospital. Let's say you have your own car. They have a problem with disability parking. It's there, but it's so abused by people who have no disability. I'm okay with parents and carers who need to help people in and out the car. By all means, use the disabled parking. But I really, big disrespect to people who go in there, just walk out because they have one meeting when the rest of us have to see multiple doctors throughout the day. So they don't have enough disabled parking, first of all. Second of all, trying to negotiate a hospital in this country, let's not talk about other establishments, is ridiculous. The wayfinding is rubbish. Sometimes you have to go up and then you have to go down and then you have to go left, right, you're lost. That is another problem. Like, people don't think wayfinding is a disability tool or even an accessibility tool, but it absolutely is. Then touching back to what the doctor said about waiting and having to take your number and blah, blah, blah. Thankfully, I don't have a problem with that. But a lot of people do, because sometimes it's not catered to the blind or the deaf. Sometimes we talk about disability as if it's just physical disability. It's not. Engagement is very low on that part. Then we move to lavatories, which is a big issue. Just because we are a country full of rainforest doesn't mean the bathroom has to be a rainforest.
The wet floors, yep.
Exactly. It's not just the fact that it's slippery. It will track my wheels all the way outside, and a hospital is supposed to be a clean place. So you don't want wheel tracks everywhere, because that's gross.
Especially
from the toilet.
I'm sorry to jump in, but do you find that there are even enough lavatories for disabled?
I would say not even. Like, for a hospital, you would think that they would have more disabled slots or more disabled lavatories in general instead of the normal ones, right? But they don't. And we're talking about in the lavatories as well. We have a whole CIRM booklet of how to design for the disabled, but I feel like it's not being used at all by builders, by policymakers. They just forget that it exists. So when you go into these disabled spaces, I expect handholds. I expect, what do you call those things? The strings that you put, emergency
pulleys. Pull cords, yeah.
The pull cords. Because if somebody falls, they should be able to grab that. But often, even if they did have it, it's too low. Mm. And the nurses, bless them, they're wonderful, will usually have to be asked to help as well. It's very awkward to ask somebody you don't know to ask you to go to the lavatories because the toilet is not low enough or it's too high or it's too low. There's no standardization. There's no sort of sliding board to assist. There's nothing that helps you do things by yourself if you quit in a different situation. There's more to say. I just can't think of any right now.
Yeah. I'd just like to go on about the wet floors and the toilets. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very difficult for me to say because I actually am in the, I chair the inpatient falls committee, and I have been trying my hardest to get people to see the point of not having wet floors in toilets. I've been told that it is a Malaysian habit and we can't get rid of it. It hurts because I know that you can have bidets. They make sure their floors are clean, and a lot more shopping centres are actually following suit. And whatever it takes to convert a toilet seat into one that squirts water does not seem to be too expensive. Then there's also specialised flooring that will allow water to actually go down. So, but again, we've been told infection control issues. But like you say, you know, you tracking dirty toilet water out on your wheelchair's wheels is probably even worse when it comes to infection control than keeping the floor dry. So so we actually need people to speak out. And unfortunately, you know, buildings, so when they build buildings, they don't listen to the end users. So there needs to be far more disabled people lobbying for involvement in the building of public buildings, as well as older people. People need to listen. These people need a voice.
Sean, do you think it's a lack of loud voices?
I'm going to parrot what the doctor said, in that the older you get, the less time you feel you have on this earth and the less energy you have to fight a system that is denying you service. So I'm hoping I never get to that point, because I'm going to be an angry woman yelling at clouds until I die, I think. But I know for a fact, coming from an NGO and an activist point of view, that a lot of people just don't make it past like the 35-year-old mark and just sort of devolve into this, I'm tired, I don't want to do this anymore, I just want to live my life. So when we say we want to hear more voices, it's very difficult to push people away from the comfort that they've built for themselves. Also, one more thing I'd like to add when it comes to healthcare and disability. When you go to the hospital, you usually have various things that you want to do, right? You want to first see the doctor, and then you would go get an x-ray, or you would go get a lung function test, and so on and so forth. One problem specifically that I will give is going to get an x-ray. Being disabled also means that the x-ray people, the radiologists, don't know how to deal with you if you cannot stand up. So they will ask a million and one questions. They will try to defer you to somebody else. And often it's a constant struggle, and it takes very many minutes instead of just standing up and getting ready. They're like, we don't know how to put you in a chair. Can you stand up? And I'm like, obviously I cannot. If I could, I probably wouldn't be here. And they'll sort of try and pass the buck and say, oh, we can't do that right now. And I'm like, we're already here. I don't have time to spend more time dealing with this. So that is one of the problems. The million and one questions that they have to sort of defer their onus to help.
So that comes to attitudes, isn't it? It's not about infrastructure anymore. It's about barriers in terms of attitudes from healthcare workers themselves. Prof Tan, your thoughts?
Yeah, I like to think of it as compassion fatigue. So, you know, initially everyone starts off being idealistic. You know, I want to change the world. I want to make everything better. And then they come across failures, you know. And our system does not allow failures. I mean, I remember from my own upbringing that, you know, if you make a mistake, the chastising, the punishment that comes with the mistake is almost worse than trying to do something. So eventually people stop trying because making mistakes comes is associated with the negativity that has been drilled into us since we were children. So there's so much that we need to do in society in order to actually break out of this, I would like to consider it a middle income trap. Because we don't ever even think about what happens if we actually fully embrace disability. Because we have an aging nation, and eventually we'll have more older people than we have children. And if we do not change our environment such that it's permissive for all these older people to get around and people with disability getting around, we are actually disadvantaging ourselves because they are actually a potentially untapped workforce. You can't say, you know, you're weak, you know, that's it. You know, so you're not going to make it because you're weak. Yeah, you need to change society such that we will continue to be able to bring in new productive workforces, not just keep bringing in foreign labor. Not that I have anything against foreigners working in this country, but this seems to be what we're doing, plugging the gap, you know, without thinking about the consequences we're doing to other people's countries. So we really need to actually learn from the mistakes of Western developed nations who actually did all this in the past. And that's why they have all these permissiveness now. That's why the environment is actually disabled friendly. We need to really pick up from their mistakes and actually make our environment disabled friendly now.
Do you think, Prof, that there is an argument to be made for moving care and the burden of care out of these specialist and tertiary hospitals more into communities so that at least half of the barriers that Shah mentioned about getting to big hospitals far away from home are at least reduced?
Yeah, I think there's an overemphasis on centralization. Yeah, so what we really need to think about is potential avoidable hospitalization. Now, why are we putting up with hospitals as busy places? Why are we agreeing to wait 8 months to see a specialist? This is just not right. There needs to be a gatekeeper. People who don't need to see specialists can already have access to what they need. And only the people who need to see specialists see specialists, then the waiting list will come down. And then the other thing is that, you know, people tend to sit in hospitals for days, sometimes weeks, waiting for tests. Can we just do the test today? And I know it sounds very idealistic, but waiting lists simply do not make sense because at the end of the day, the same number of people still see the doctor.
Mm. I still want to pick on that point about the attitudes a little bit more. We can say, Prof, and I agree with you that as a society, our attitudes need to change, but here we are already in a system where healthcare workers are face to face with people who have certain challenges and their attitudes and their perhaps some discriminatory behaviors can present an even bigger problem for people like Shah. Shah, I just want to get your thoughts on this. You know, how do you see, because after this I want to ask you about changes we can make to infrastructure, but changes to attitudes, I don't know, what do you think?
People talk about attitudes as if it's so disjointed from infrastructure. I think that's not the case at all. People are a product of their environment. So when you have an environment that actively promotes helpfulness within a community, for example, or within hospitals, maybe better training, maybe just a basic understanding of how to help a person get in and out on and off various equipment, I think that would have helped miles than just basic platitudes of, we will have this, we will have that, and it will cost money. No, just better training. Better training will alleviate so many excuses that can be given from a health care perspective. It's like, oh, we can't touch you because we're afraid you might break. That's not a very good excuse. You're supposed to be trained in this. I'm not going to take that. So I think we have to stop putting them into separate categories.
All right. Fair enough. So then when we look at the environment and the infrastructure, what kind of changes would you like to see?
Like I mentioned before, better training, understanding that disability comes in various forms. It's not just a physical disability. It's not just for the aged. It's not just them being unable to be there in the moment or being weak or something. It's knowing that these services need to happen, and these are the ways that you can assist in that happening as fast as possible. Because we don't want people arguing within, for example, an X-ray room when there are 10 other patients that want to use the service as well, right? So the faster you get in, the faster you do the thing and get out, the faster you can have a turnover. Training is one thing. I don't like the idea of this country using money as an excuse. Like, we can't get this equipment because it's too expensive. That's probably the dumbest thing I've ever heard, because we have so many things that have come before these high-tech equipment that can be used, like basic slings or rams that you can make out of wood. It's not a high-tech excuse. What other things? Oh,
rams that are not 45 degree angles though.
Oh my god. Like at this point, I think I could join the X Games and win a gold medal or something. Me and other disabled persons. Other thing is this whole thing where the government likes to do things for us without us. And I absolutely cannot fathom, how can you assume that you know how a person with disabilities or a person who is in geriatric situation would perceive a space when you're not there yet? When you don't even ask the important questions, you don't have us be in the meeting. I think that's another thing that needs to be implemented. If you want to make something, make sure the person you're making it for is there giving you advice.
So there are absolutely no groups from the community in the room at the table at all?
Most of the time, yes.
They tend to work in silos, I have to say, because things are usually done very last minute, very limited timelines, and very little emphasis or resources actually devoted to getting patient groups to give input. But actually, I mean, I have involved patient groups in my projects. They're incredibly nice. You know, it's like they're so happy to be consulted. They will come at short notice. So they don't even try, I don't think, because it's faster just to do it within ourselves. And part of it is like, it's training. So when we go to school, we actually emphasize on academic achievement. I'm a professor of medicine, and I have to say that I want my students not to just concentrate on my study, on their studies. I want them to be able to do everything else and pass their exams, because that's what you need to be a doctor. The selection of doctors is very important. We need to concentrate on selecting those who have more empathy, who are more all-rounded. We also need to actually emphasize teaching communication. So there's lots of things that actually leads to all these quite unhelpful building of infrastructure.
Shah, can I ask you, you said that largely because of the pandemic, you've not been to a hospital for 2 years. Has it affected any follow-ups that you've needed? Would you say that as a whole, the problems and the challenges with accessibility and navigation in the healthcare system could potentially affect your care?
Absolutely. This past 2 years has been such a huge problem for me. I actually had a dip in muscular use in strength in general for the end bit of 2020 and the beginning bit of 2021. It feels like just one really long year. What I didn't like was I used to have, there was a rehab center that I used to visit very frequently, as it was the only place that I could go to that had hydrotherapy services. The minute COVID happened, I would call weekly and say, hey, can we be expected to continue my hydrotherapy? Because people forget that hydrotherapy is so good when you don't have full muscle ability. They kept delaying it, saying, no, we can't. I understand that it's because COVID, water, you don't want things to spread. It's kind of a warm, moist environment. So even with chlorine, that doesn't help. I get it. A year later, I called and I was met with the driest comment of, oh, we can't accept you here anymore. You have to get another referral from a main hospital and you need to go see a neuro. So I called that particular hospital that I would usually get a referral from, and trying to get information about who I'm supposed to see at what time and then follow up things that I need to do is wild. They couldn't give me answers. I was like, okay, when do I have to come in? What time do I have to come in? Just might as well just go to space, I guess. It's not helpful. At least get somebody on the phone that knows how the system works so I can plan my day and I can ask people to help to send me there. Because we just don't have that kind of time anymore.
It's a disastrous situation because, you know, we, in using COVID as an excuse, we totally shut down services. And, you know, people are waiting too long for the cancer surgery. People for my situation, my patients are still not back because they're still asked to go hiding because they're still the vulnerable group. And so 2 years later, my memory clinic still has 2/3 attendance. A lot of them are staying away because they're scared. We still have reduced numbers because of the need to fulfill SOPs. I don't know when we're going to catch up with all this backlog. And, you know, I could even feel my emotions well up with what you just said. You know, hydrotherapy, come on, you know, you could do something more like test before you go in or something like that. Because what we're going to have to pick up with, at least you're motivated, but what we're going to have to pick up after this pandemic, oh, it hurts. Yeah. And they still haven't put out taken away all the barriers coming into the hospital, even though we've opened up now. I thought 1st of April, barriers off. But no, you still have to do that snake to go into the hospital, and there's still a policeman standing there. It is horrendous.
I marvel at the fact that they think the virus respects the barriers as well. You know, Prof, earlier you talked about why it's important for, as a larger society, for us to recognize that, you were speaking from the perspective of a geriatrician, of course, you know, that we are in an aging population and these are issues that are real and immediate to us. But Shah, from your perspective, you know, and just fighting against that perception that people with disabilities are a quote-unquote minority and therefore, you know, we'll just do the bare minimum, if at all, for you. And you know, you should be grateful, right? I want to hear how you would push back against that and how you would argue that, you know, put on your best angry person argument. Like, why should it be so fundamental that healthcare facilities are easy to get to and to navigate for every single person, regardless of your whether or not you have an impairment?
I think I'm going to answer that first by a oft-quoted quote by an anthropologist, Margaret Mead, when was asked by a student what she considered to be the first sign of civilization in a culture. She said that the first sign of civilization in a culture, in an ancient culture, was that a femur that had been broken and then healed. She explained that within an animal kingdom, you know, you break a bone, you die. But we're cultured, we're civilized. Somebody breaks a bone, we heal it. That also means including people with disabilities, people with mental impairment. Any of these things are considered healthcare. You take care of the civilization, right? We're involved in this. whether I'm going to say the word pre-disabled, because people have this assumption that if you're born abled, you will never become disabled. Not true. Fun fact, if you take a big fall, I'm sorry, buddy, you're one of us now. So taking that quote from Margaret Mead, we have to understand that being disabled is not the be-all and end-all. You doing the bare minimum for us does not help you at all. If we're looking at it in a capitalist society point of view, us being disabled should not take us out of the societal expectations of being able to help within an economy. The doctor said that we are an untapped market. That is absolutely true. There is a study, I think the UN study, I can't remember end quote exactly, but apparently every nation has at least 15% of people who are disabled, not including people who are aged. So that's 15% of the market you are not tapping. That's 15% of the market you are denying service to. That's 15% of the market that can pay for services and boost so many money-related things in a country. So when we say, help us to help you, we mean it. Equity is a thing. Equity is a thing that we need, definitely. It's not just equality. It's letting us participate in society that would become a boon in a collective.
I'm going to wrap up this conversation now. Any final thoughts, though, before we wrap up?
I'm just going to say that somebody brought this up ages ago. They said that things will only change when the largest generation, the boomer generation, becomes old and haggard and disabled. I don't want to wait for that. I think if we wait for that, it's too late.
No, it's coming soon, actually. Yeah. You're old. Yeah. But you know, just don't do unto others what you do not want to be done unto yourself. Don't treat others how you do not want to be treated.
Absolutely. And I think I really resonate with what Shah said about the pre-disabled stage of life, right? Because we know about so many more impairments that could happen mentally, functionally, cognitively. I think as we grow older, all of us are going to experience that at some point, or our family members. We are all in this together, not separated or segregated from one another. Thank you so much. I've been speaking to Professor Dr. Tan Mo Pin, consultant geriatrician, and Aisha Roos, who's living with spinal muscular atrophy. But she's also an interior designer, an aged and disability fit out specialist. So she's been sharing from all of those perspectives about how we need to make our healthcare system more friendly for those with mobility and functional issues. You've been listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.